This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Zoloft, Xanax, Wellbutrin, Ritalin, Risperdal, Zyprexa. The alphabet soup of psychiatric drugs is as familiar to many as the alphabet itself. The number of Americans taking these medications has increased dramatically in recent years. One survey found that upwards of 10% of Americans, more than 27 million people, are using antidepressants, just one class of psychiatric drugs. So, according to conventional wisdom, if so many people are being treated, then the amount of disabling mental illness should be dropping, right? Something akin to, say, the effect that new treatments have had on HIV/AIDS. Many people who have the disease are now living relatively normal lives. But one investigator says the exact opposite is true for mental illness. The number of people who are disabled by mental illness is exploding. And he says it's the drugs themselves that might actually be causing a new epidemic of mental illness in America. That's today's talker. We're joined now by Robert Whitaker, longtime science journalist, Boston-based, and author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. Robert Whitaker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Andrew Nirenberg. He's director of the Bipolar Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Nirenberg, welcome to Radio Boston as well.
Thanks for having me here.
We should also note that just this week, Robert Whitaker made grand rounds at MGH. He had a packed house of doctors to hear his provocative thesis. There's truly excellent coverage of how those grand rounds went at WBUR's health policy blog, commonhealth.wbur.org. So, Robert Whitaker, you open your book and many of the interviews that you've done about this with a very provocative set of statistics on just how many people in America are disabled by mental illness. Can you walk us through what you're calling this explosion of mental illness in America?
Sure, and let's just look at the number of people on SSI or SSDI. Those are government programs, Social Security programs, who receive a disability check because they've been disabled by mental illness. In other words, they were declared eligible for that program based on that disability. Now, in 1987, there were 1.25 million adults, 18 to 65, on those rolls for that purpose. Now, this is when we get the big explosion in psychiatric drugs. Prozac comes onto the market in 1987. We get the SSRIs, et cetera. So now you would think that the number of people on those disability lists would stay the same, as you'd say, or maybe even go down. What's happened? Well, today we have more than 4 million adults on those disability rolls. So there's been a tripling of the number of adults on disability rolls in that 20-year span. And that raises a question, and the question that I investigate in this book: what is going on? Why are we seeing this rise even as we have increased medication use?
The number is even more astonishing for children. You've written that in 1987, only 5.5% of children on disability rolls were there due to mental illness, and now it's upward of 50%?
Yes, so the number of people on disability for children has risen something from 16,200 in 1987 to more than 500,000 today, and what you're saying is the percentage that they comprise of the disability rolls has risen from about 5% to 50%. So you're seeing this explosion.
So this is the basis upon which you are applying that word epidemic of mental illness. And so how is it that you feel the drugs that are used to treat mental illness themselves are at the heart of this?
Well, the disability numbers just raise a question, right? They ask the question is, how do medications shape the long-term course of major mental disorders? Okay, and that's what I investigate in this book, say for adults. And I do it for four disorders: schizophrenia, anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder. And it's very complicated about how you do that. But what you do find when you try to look at long-term outcomes, and this is the controversial part, is that they do increase, on the whole, the chronicity of the disorder, meaning that you actually see people having more chronic symptoms long-term than in the unmedicated cohorts, on the whole. Okay, that's the surprising thing. And you do see, time and time again, and we can talk about the studies, that you actually increase the risk of going on disability on the whole with this paradigm of care. And I just want to make one thing really clear. Mm. The medications clearly can have a use over the short term. And there are some people that clearly do well on them on the long term as well. But what we're talking about is how do they shape overall outcomes? And when you look at that, it's clear that they shape outcomes. They increase the chronicity of disorders, and they actually increase the risk of disability. And we can talk to studies that show that to be true.
So, listeners, what do you make of this? Are psychiatric drugs the problem, or are they an essential part of treatment for psychiatric disorders? Is what Robert Whittaker saying, does it have a ring of truth to you, or does he actually have it backwards? Is the increased use of drugs simply because we have more people who are getting treatment that they need? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Andrew Nierenberg of the Bipolar Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, let me just get your top-line response here. I mean, it's a pretty strong indictment that Robert Whittaker's making of these drugs that are very familiar to so many Americans.
So we have some agreements and disagreements. I think the agreements that we have is that these are chronic disorders in many, not in everybody, that everybody does need treatment, and we could agree or disagree about which treatments are needed or for how long they're needed. Where we disagree is about the explanation. Mr. Whittaker is saying that the drugs increase chronicity and disability. And after reading his book very carefully, I think he actually has it backwards.
And why is that?
And that's because the studies that he cites, which he can do very well, essentially looks at naturalistic outcomes. You take a group of people, you follow them over time, and you see how they do. It would be as if you looked at people who had accidents, and those people who weren't treated for their accidents ended up doing better in the long term versus those people who were treated for their accidents do poorly in the long term. You can't blame treatment on the outcome in that way.
Okay. And what do you make of this this idea that even especially among children, that the rise in mental illness seems to be particularly strong, and the relationship of drugs like Ritalin on that statistic there?
So one of the things is that if you look epidemiologically and you look at large groups of people, in fact, most children with disorders are not treated at all. If anything, the problem is undertreatment overall as opposed to overtreatment. The second problem is access to care, because there are very few child psychiatrists around and there just aren't enough who can do a careful job over the long term. In terms of, again, blaming the drugs on their outcomes, I think they have it backwards. What a lot of kids have is a lot of problems. They don't get the proper treatment. And to say that the treatment is making it worse, I think, is just not right.
Robert Whittaker, I want to bring you back in here, obviously, into the conversation. But I also have to say that while I appreciate the very civil tone of this conversation, I do know that your thesis has actually really raised a lot of passions in the field of psychiatry. I mean, Dr. Nierenberg, it was reported in our Common Health blog that at Grand Rounds this week, you said that Robert Whittaker is accused of, quote, gratuitous and misinformed attacks. I mean, like, you're taking this very seriously.
Well, Ashok, that was very specific in part of his book where he was criticizing the link between academia and industry and really just repeating other things that are in the newspapers and the media. And those things are really gratuitous because there's a deep misunderstanding of what that really is.
Okay, well, feel free to engage with each other civilly here, but don't wait for me to necessarily referee, because there's truthfully passion here, and I want people to hear it.
There's been a couple questions, and we'll just I think it would be nice to have some studies out there just so we can see what we're talking about. Okay, one study was a study done by Martin Harrow. He's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, and it's the best study of this type we've ever had. And here's the study. Beginning in early 1980s, he identified a cohort of 145 psychotic patients from two different hospitals, 64 diagnosed with schizophrenia, 81 with other psychotic disorders. And now he just follows them for 15 years, mm-hmm. and he follows them up regularly, and he looks at how they're doing and whether they're using medications. Now, as the background of this, think of this. Let's just look at the 64 schizophrenia patients. We believe you have to be on medications for life, right? That's what is told. Now, in this study, at the end of 2 years, the off-medication group started doing better. And by the end of 4.5 years, the recovery rate for the off-medication group was about 40% versus 5% for those on medication. And that eightfold higher recovery rate stayed throughout that study for the off-medication group. Now, that's very stunning, right? That's very different from what we believe. Now, one other thing, because I know Dr. Nierenberg's just eager to come in here.
So are our callers. Okay, so I definitely want to get to
them. Real quickly on this. There was that schizophrenia group, better for the off medication. The other psychotic disorders group, better for the off medication group. He divided his schizophrenia patients into good prognosis patients and bad prognosis patients. Good prognosis off did better than the good prognosis on. The bad prognosis off did better than the bad prognosis on. So the point is, at the very least, that really challenges us to think, because we believe so strongly you got to be on medications for life. This was the only study we have of this thing that charted schizophrenia outcomes for 15 years.
Longitudinally,
Yeah, from the beginning. And what did we see? We saw outcomes that totally went against what we believed to be true. And one real quick thing on the children thing, if I may, because you asked how the medications could be stirring disability. If you look at kids, say, medicated with Ritalin for ADHD. The NIMH ran a long-term study back
in the National Institutes of Mental Health
in the 1990s. At the end of 3 years, being on medication was a marker of deterioration, not a benefit.
That's actually something I want to get into further a little later, but let's get Dr. Nirenberg have his response. And I do understand that there are competing studies, and you can sort of pick and choose which ones support a theory, so I don't necessarily want the conversation to devolve into quoting one study after the other, but please do give us your response to the Harrow study that that Robert Whitaker is talking about.
So we have a profound disagreement about the interpretation of the Harrow study, and this goes back to the example I said before. This is just a group of patients who are treated and they're followed over time. There's no randomization. There's no equal opportunity to have the outcome of interest. So this is just like taking people who were in a bad accident, and some people needed long-term treatment, some people didn't need treatment at all. And if you say at the end of 15 years, the people who really needed a lot of treatment after their accident did much worse because they got treated, that's the equivalent of what Mr. Whitaker is interpreting the Harrow study.
Okay. Listeners, what do you make of all this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to the mountain of callers we do have. Russell's calling from AIR. Welcome to Radio Boston, Russell.
Yes, good morning, or afternoon, rather, sorry. So I was just calling because I'm a 37-year-old, and growing up as a child, I exhibited many of the signs and or symptoms of ADHD, but my mom always, was one of those parents, like, you just need to settle down and put your nose to the grindstone and whatnot. So managed through high school and college and did all right. Well, within the last 2 years, I actually had my primary care physician suggest Ritalin because he said that I was exhibiting many of the classic signs of adult deficit.
And has the Ritalin helped, Russell?
Tremendously. I never even realized that there was an issue until I started taking it, and now I'm a small business owner, which is actually flourishing in this financial climate, and I'm able to stay on task, and I can't say enough about it, and I just wish I had known this 15 years ago as opposed to only 2 or 3.
Russell, thank you so much for your call. Let's get to some other callers here. We actually have a comment on our website. Chuck writes, I have ADD. Before being diagnosed and treated, I graduated from college, Phi Beta Kappa. Now, with ADD meds, I can't read more than 4 pages a day. And with my antidepressants, I'm more depressed than I've ever been, and I've tried about 20 different ones. That's the opposite take on treatment for ADD. Let's get another call in here. Mary's calling from Worcester. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I was 17, I had moderate bipolar disorder, and I was put on Prozac and Zoloft, but I wasn't given proper counseling and care, and I was not suicidal. And then I was put on Prozac and Zoloft for about a year-long period, and my bipolar went out of control, and I became suicidal, and I tried to take my own life, and the doctors took me off all medication, and after the fact, they decided that I was one of the few patients with adverse reactions to the drugs they've found that since then, that there are some, especially teenagers, where there's an actual possibility that the symptoms could get worse with the antidepressants. And since then, I've been about 10 years now with no medication, and I'm a fully functioning bipolar adult.
Mary, thank you so much for your call. Robert Whitaker, and Dr. Nirenberg as well, here we already have, just in a small sample of Radio Boston callers, the spectrum of people's reactions to these drugs.
Well, there is a very varied reaction. If you look at the spectrum of reactions to drugs, it is big. I mean, in whatever diagnosis you look at it, you get people respond. Some people respond well, some so-so, and some very poorly. And so whenever you have these call-ins, you're going to have people calling in from those different parts of the spectrum. And then what I sort of am making a plea with this book is, let's try to look at what the long-term outcomes data we have says about how we're shaping outcomes in the aggregate. There is one important thing to listen to, even in these stories, is maybe what you really need is a paradigm of care that says for some people, medications can be helpful long-term, and for some people, they can be harmful, and you have to figure out who can benefit and who does not. Whereas the paradigm of care we have to now is this idea, everybody on meds for life. That's part of what's broken.
Dr. Nierenberg, that actually raises a question that I had. That is, the standard of care is, it seems to be today, that drugs are the first line, and therapy is actually harder to get for a number of reasons, and one being that insurance often doesn't cover it.
So certainly insurance is a big problem in terms of what covers it. But in fact, there's no one standard of care that means that you get treated with drugs immediately, that you get treated forever with it. In fact, what we're trying to do is personalize the treatment for everybody who has psychiatric disorders, and we really need more research and more research funds to do so.
Robert Whitaker, there's another aspect of your book which really caught my attention, and that is you seem to be, you hint in a couple passages that in the 70s and 80s, when psychiatry itself took this turn towards seeing disorders as biological in origin, you know, the brain being a biological origin, and we could understand, hopefully one day understand it down to its most chemical level, and therefore treat with chemicals disorders of the brain. And are you saying that was a mistake for psychiatry to look at the brain that way? And why?
No. I'm not saying that's a mistake at all, okay? What I'm saying is that beginning in 1980, we got DSM-3, which very much put this into this idea of sort of medical disorders. And then what happened is psychiatry began telling us a story. And psychiatry began telling us a story about how they were unlocking the mysteries of the biological causes of mental disorders, and that they had found that depression was caused by low serotonin, and the antidepressants, by upping serotonin, fixed that chemical problem, just like insulin for diabetes. In fact, they didn't find, the brain is so mysterious, they didn't find that to be so. They didn't find that depression was due to a simple low serotonin, which was then fixed by the drug. So my complaint is that they told us a false story. They told us a story of revolutionary advance, of unlocking the mysteries of mental disorders. That's not what happened. The biological causes of mental disorders really remain unknown. It doesn't mean there's not biological causes. It means that they remain unknown.
Dr. Nierenberg.
And here again is where we have a profound disagreement. There have been amazing advances in understanding basic brain function, how the medications work, what they do, how things change, and it's become much more sophisticated than it was 30 years ago.
Let's take another call here. Joe is calling from Quincy. Welcome to Radio Boston, Joe.
Hi, thanks. I have depression and anxiety. I've been taking Celexa for depression and Clonopin for anxiety. I've been on Clonopin for at least 4 years, and I'm up to 4 milligrams a day, and I've been wanting to quit for quite a while. My doctor's attitude is, well, you'll quit when you're ready, kind of thing. I've been on other benzodiazepine anxiety drugs before in an attempt to like get off of this Clonopin in particular, and I just find it's impossible. Whatever anxiety that got me taking Clonopin in the first place, the anxiety I feel when I try to wean myself off of it is 10 times worse, and I really don't feel like my doctor is even like wants to help me get off of them.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but thank you so much for sharing your story. We'll get our guest to respond to it in just a minute, but I also want to say that Amanda is writing on our website something quite similar, that she was put on several medications for depression. When the time came for her to stop taking those drugs, this is Amanda writing, she said, I was told that I would need to take other meds to help curb the side effects of withdrawal. It took about 6 months. It was really shocking how my brain chemistry had changed due to the dosage. Let's take another quick call here. Zachary is calling from Littleton. Welcome to Radio Boston, Zachary.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, So it was a few years ago, and I was told by my doctor I had ADD, and I was put on Metadate, and I think it really helps me. I wouldn't be able to concentrate without it.
Zachary, do you mind if I ask how old you are now?
I'm 13.
And you, how old were you when you were put on the medication for ADD?
Maybe 6.
So you've been on it for half your life.
Yeah.
And how has it changed, you know, how you are at school or how you are at home?
Well, it helps me concentrate. I totally zone out without it.
Zachary, thanks so much for calling. Robert Whitaker, you spend, I think for me, one of the more eye-opening sets of statistics that you bring up have to do with children, and we talked about it a little bit before, and mental illness and the treatment. I mean, basically, you've said in a previous interview that we read online that juvenile bipolar or manic breaks, diagnoses did not exist before children were given drugs like Ritalin?
Yeah, if you chart if you go back to the 1960s and 1970s, people say juvenile bipolar illness or manic depressive illness, as it was known, and just didn't exist in prepubertal children. They just didn't find it. And then if you chart the rise of this diagnosis, you find like the first case studies are in children that have been either medicated with antidepressants or stimulants. And if you look at cohorts, and it goes on like that, and you can find literature that, for example, that says if you go on a stimulant, you have a certain risk of having a manic or a psychotic episode on that. And something like 10% of kids who go on ADHD medication today eventually convert to bipolar illness. Same with antidepressants. And if you look at any cohort of large group of kids diagnosed with juvenile bipolar illness, watch how many began with exposure to either a stimulant or an antidepressant. That becomes their gateway to this more serious diagnosis.
Dr. Nierenberg, let me get your response to that, but also follow up by asking that I believe sometime in the 1990s, the National Institutes of Mental Health started looking at Ritalin and whether what kind of benefit it was giving, if any, to children diagnosed with ADHD. And as part of that study or following that study, William Pelham, I'm reading from the State University of New York at Buffalo, said that, quote, "We need to confess to parents that we found no benefit." So
That's simply not true. The benefit is actually extraordinary, and the difference between the kids who are treated with the stimulants versus placebo is profound. And what's even more important is that untreated ADHD over time is associated with car accidents, smoking, divorce, drug abuse, and work problems. So we know that from looking at the people who are adults who have it or have had it and what happened to them over time. The other thing that I want to comment on is that in terms of the implication from Mr. Whitaker on cause and effect, that these drugs are causing it, shows really that there's a lack of awareness of developmental psychiatry, meaning that a lot of dysregulations happen early and that over time people develop the disorder. So for people who have bipolar disorder, frequently they have ADHD and many of them are untreated.
May I ask a question here? So why, prior to the use of stimulants and antidepressants, didn't prepubertal children develop manic depressive illness?
Actually, they did. So
no, they you go look at the literature. Time and time again, they said they do not. We don't even have cases of it. It doesn't look like it can develop in prepubertal children.
Yeah,
look at the literature.
Here's where we actually not only have a profound disagreement, but in terms of we did a study of bipolar adults and asked them about their childhood disorders. And the rates of untreated ADHD in these patients, untreated depression, was enormously high. So that would go against your assertion.
If I may interrupt, I mean, obviously this is something that a lot of people do care about, and many of them are actually on the line, on the phone with us. So let's see if we can get to some more of them. Jason is calling from Cambridge. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jason.
Hi. I have about a 40-year history of dealing with this stuff. Every member of my immediate family, I'm going to try to be quick here, I've had extremely positive results with medication, most recently including lithium, and some disastrous ones that I won't go into. And one of my points is that it takes a long time, in my case and in many other people's cases, a long time to get an accurate diagnosis, a provider that you trust, and it's so important to stick with the advice given. Otherwise, the individual can't find out what the results are. And second point, although I'm not going to debate any specific points of these studies. Two things. If one has an opinion, it's very easy to quote the studies that fit that opinion, and that the apparent increased incidence of mental illness in the population may have a lot to do with a reduction of the stigma and the ability of providers to make an accurate diagnosis.
Jason, thank you so much for your call. We just got a couple minutes left, so I want to get responses from our guests, but I just also want to read this comment from Catherine on our website, who asks, could the rise in disabling mental illness be connected to drugs being used as a band-aid by generalists? It seems that the drugs might be used in lieu of a referral to a specialist who might give more comprehensive treatment. Robert Whitaker, we've just got a minute and a half left, so your response.
Let's put it this way. I think the medications do have a place in the toolbox, but they have to be used very smartly, very selectively, and by people who've really thought about this in a very thorough fashion.
Dr. Andrew Nierenberg, last question to you. If there is so much benefit, and I know millions of people definitely think there are, and they have benefited from many of these drugs, why is it that some of these outcome studies, such as a 2007 National Institute of Mental Health outcome study on schizophrenia, that said, basically I'm reading, it found that, it's the one that Robert Whitaker was talking about, the Harrow study, that 40% of people who went off drugs actually did better. Why is it that we never hear about these things? These studies don't make it into the press. They don't get the kind of publicity that the ones that support drug outcomes do.
Well, in fact, there are some studies that are done very carefully where people are randomized and then they have the equal opportunity to look at what the outcome is. Again, the Harrow study did not have that, and that's why it's not a big deal. The other thing about the Harrow study also is that there were only 8 patients in the group who did well. This is not a big study.
Okay, at the end of the day, all of us who are listening, all of us who are patients or we maybe know people who suffer from mental illness or who are in the medical practice themselves, we have a choice to make. And here's my last question for a couple seconds, and I'm going to ask you to keep it short here. What should we do with these competing studies, with your thesis that drugs themselves are the problems? There's got to be something that we can do today in dealing with the questions that you raised.
Yeah, in February, there's going to be a national conference that was triggered by this book. There's psychiatrists coming. It's going to be in Portland, Oregon. Psychiatrists, providers of care, and they're going to be looking at these questions and trying to figure out how do they respond to the long-term outcomes that were reported on in Anatomy of an Epidemic. So it's triggered a national sort of thought process.
Robert Whitaker, author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, thank you so much for joining us. And Dr. Andrew Nierenberg, Director of Bipolar Research at Massachusetts General Hospital and Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for being here as well.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll check in with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.